Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, and welcome to New Books in Genocide Studies, part of the New Books Network of podcasts. My name is Kelly McFall from Newman University, and I'm the host of the show. Today, we're continuing our occasional series on Rwanda. So far, we've talked with Michael Barnett and Sarah Brown and Herman Salton, and in the future, we'll be talking with Tim Longman and Aaron Jesse. Today, I'm thrilled to have John Nathaniel Clark on the show. John is the author of British Media and the Rwandan Genocide, published by Routledge. And I'm looking forward to the conversation we're going to have. So, John, welcome to the show, and thanks for joining us on New Books in Genocide Studies.
Thanks very much for having me, Kelly.
So, John, we always start the same way, and that's to give you a chance to say something about your personal background and what you're doing now.
Sure. So I'm Canadian, born in Ottawa, Canada, to a Pakistani mother who was from Quetta, on the border with Afghanistan, and an Ulster Irish father, also named John Clark, who is from Belfast. So I grew up in Ottawa and I think spent most of my time concerned about playing baseball more than things academic. At least that's what my high school teachers used to lament. But nevertheless, I managed to get into university. I went to the University of Western Ontario and Huron College in particular, finishing a degree in philosophy and politics. And at Huron College, and then on to Cambridge University, first at Clare Hall, where I did a master's, an MPhil, and then a PhD at Peterhouse. So I had an extraordinary experience, both as an undergraduate and a graduate, and the good fortune to be around really interesting academics and peers as well. From there, my career departed slightly from the more academic track. I joined the office of the then Canadian Foreign Minister, Lloyd Axworthy, as a policy advisor, and had a very intense 2 years working for him in a very demanding job and a very enjoyable job at a time when I think Canada was playing an important role around the world through the minister and through the prime minister at the time. And then I worked a bit on the election, writing policy elements for the Liberal Party platform, what we call the Red Book in Canada. And then departed from that, having really enjoyed my time working in politics and actually learned a great deal, things which I still apply in my current job and in my role with the UN. I really felt I wanted to be closer to the reality of what was happening on the ground. I mean, I think it's one thing, Canada was on the Security Council when I was working for Minister Axworthy, and I think it's one thing to see the process, for better or for worse, through which council resolutions are drafted and to a degree implemented. But very different to be on the ground trying to interpret and apply those resolutions to crises. And so I joined the UN and served in a variety of roles on the humanitarian and recovery side, doing policy-oriented work, for example, developing early warning methods to try and identify crises and prevention strategies before they erupt. But then also on the sharp end in Sudan, where, among other things, I was in charge of negotiating access in a number of cases in a number of states, and also leading the response and coordinating the response to flooding in Sudan in 2007, in which we had, if I remember correctly, it was over 500,000 people affected. So it was a big enough emergency that it drew in a lot of resources and attention. And then from there, I shifted gears. I moved to the Middle East, here to Jerusalem, joined the Special Coordinator's Office, the UN Special Coordinator for the Middle East Peace Process, who was then Robert Seri and is now Nikolai Mladenov. And I'm now working as the head of the office of the Quartet here in Jerusalem. So it's a pleasure to be with you. And today I speak in a personal capacity, as you might expect. Mm-hmm. But I think if you look at my CV, my parents once said, they said, you know, what are you doing with your career? And I said, well, I'm not really too sure. I said, it's more serendipity than design. And they said, well, it's that, but it also makes it look like you can't hold a job down for more than 2 years, which may also be the case as well.
So I've got to ask, so you've done a PhD. How often do you apply what you did as an academic and as a grad student to the job you do now? Mm.
So I think that there are analytic skills that I acquired as doing a PhD and subsequently a postdoc, which still serve me well, whether that's in terms of actually thinking carefully through a problem or undertaking analysis. I think the part that the period in Canadian politics really added was an understanding of how to move beyond the analysis to strategies for trying to affect change. And of course, academics do that a great deal, but I think it's also a very different thing when you are an actor in the room as opposed to an analyst outside the room. So I would say that it's of enduring benefit and value, though I have to tell you that in preparation for this interview, I had to go back to my book to try and remember what I was on about when I initially wrote it.
That's all of our dirty secret, isn't it?
That's right. I was going to say it might speak more to my limitations than to my academic background. I'm not really sure.
No, I remember as a graduate student welcoming a very highly respected military historian who I still highly respect. And we had asked him there to talk about his new book, but I asked him a question about a book he'd written, a decade or so earlier. As a naive graduate student, fully expecting that this wonderful professor must remember everything he had written. And he just looked at me with this bemused look on his face. And he said, well, that book was 10 years ago. I don't remember that.
Well, there you go. Well, I feel better. Yeah. That gives me some measure of comfort.
Your book's about the media and Rwanda. What drove you to be interested in that topic?
Well, I think that there were a number of factors. So I think that there was in my background before going to graduate school, I spent a time working again in Canadian politics. There was what we in Canada describe as a special joint committee on defense policy. So it's the House of Commons and the Senate that get together to try and prepare a strategy on Canada's defense expenditure and changes in structure of military, et cetera, et cetera. And I served as a staff member for one of the co-chairs of that committee, Senator Debeney. Pierre Debeney, who was a very kind man. The discussion that we had in that committee was, yes, about Canada's role. At the time, there was a desire or a need for people to understand that in the mid-1990s, I think the committee filed its report in 1994, that there was a change from the traditional type of peacekeeping with which Canada had been most closely associated and contributed most effectively to the type of peace enforcement and peacemaking that was not just on the horizon, but already a reality with the end of the Cold War. And so that was one set of discussions where, you know, it was very practical. And the moment that you shifted, and I don't want to underestimate the level of interest in broader questions underlying intervention, its objectives, mm-hmm. et cetera. But it was a very policy, very practically focused discussion. And in contrast, on the academic side, I had an abiding interest in political theory, which I acquired from some tremendous professors at Huron College. And that was not just domestic in terms of how the body politic should be organized, but also questions about how we extend those values that we hold dear and feel are at the core of our political arrangements within countries. And how do we extend those beyond our own borders, and what are our obligations, et cetera? And so I became interested in questions about ethics and humanitarian intervention. This is as a master's student now, and thought that the disagreements or the different views that people tended to have, whether, you know, at a practical level, the committee members with which I dealt as a support staffer to the senator, or other policymakers, that the core values, the core issues that they had on intervention were in fact a deeper reflection of their ethical predispositions, whether that was, you know, deontological arguments or consequentialism or cosmopolitan morality or communitarian morality. And so in a sense, you know, I found that neither side was having a discussion with the other in a sensible manner. And so the interest in trying to put those two things together sort of led to this question about, okay, if you're looking at how these ideas actually affect policymaking, how these big ethical and philosophic ideas affect policymaking, how do you do it? And I think, you know, there are various traditions of intellectual history and ways of approaching these things, but my interest was in seeing, okay, how do these ideas manifest themselves in a debate about an actual intervention? The media, of course, was globalized at that stage, but there was greater access to stories which would traditionally not have been on in the living rooms of Western countries, let alone the policy agendas of states capable of intervention. And so the notion or the intention was to try and create a way of measuring the use of those concepts and then statistically analyzing the extent to which they appeared to affect parliamentary debate and by extension, though it's not a one-to-one relationship, governmental policy. So it's a rather long answer to a fairly straightforward question, but I think it was just this fusion of two areas and then trying to work out, okay, if that's what I'm trying to study in microcosm, what is the right microcosm and how do we make this operational analytically?
So that's an obvious, you've just given me a very handy bridge to the next question, which is how do you do this? And let me start by saying, so you are the person who just used the word deontological, and although you didn't use R squared, you kind of imply it.
Yes.
How do you think of yourself as a scholar as you approach this? What is this book doing?
Yeah. That's a kind of self-reflective question that I'm not normally capable of answering. Sorry, Kelly, go ahead.
No, go. You're up.
Yeah. So I think I don't know that I thought of myself as really anything within one discipline or another. I mean, you know, if the nature of the book and the analysis undertaken, I think, draws from, to a degree, the historical tradition, if only because, you know, I'm writing about things that took place 20 years ago. It's very social science oriented or statistically oriented in part of the analytic approach. But then there are also heavy qualitative dimensions. You know, historians don't have the luxury of interviewing many of the people who were central to whatever endeavor they're studying simply because they're no longer with us. I, on the other hand, was lucky in that, you know, a number of men and women very graciously agreed to sit down and talk, whether that was former Prime Minister Blair, Lord Hurd, Sir Malcolm Rifkind, and a range of journalists as well that were actually involved in covering the crisis. So I guess the answer is that I suppose I see myself as a pragmatist. I don't know if that's acceptable academically these days, but I don't feel wedded to any one tradition. And I don't think I ever thought of myself as in one tradition. I have to say it did create challenges for me. Because at the time at Cambridge, the international relations sat within the Faculty of History, which, you know, is a legacy of, I think, the way in which the discipline had been viewed in Great Britain. And so I think I was something of a mystery to many of my colleagues. And I remember being invited to give a lecture at what the time was a pretty big deal for me, a lunchtime seminar series where the faculty and graduate students would come and people would be invited from outside. And I remember launching into this discussion about R-squared results and t-tests and all the rest of it. And I looked up from what I was delivering and saw either, you know, a great need for volumes of coffee to keep people awake or utter confusion. And so I asked, you know, is this familiar to anybody? And of course, no one said anything. Yeah. Now, at the end of this, the funny part of the story was that my supervisor, Jeffrey Edwards, who was also a great supervisor and was a very good friend to me while going through this PhD, asked a question. And he said, look, this is all terribly interesting, and it's clear that you can add and you can subtract. But, you know, the question is, you know, why bother? And at the time I thought, geez, you know, thanks very much, Jeffrey. But actually, in a sense, it was the most important question that he could have asked, because, you know, it's very easy to have a statistical sledgehammer for problems that are, or issues that are relatively straightforward. And in a sense, both in undertaking the analysis and also in writing it up in a manner that, you know, one hopes someone might eventually read, putting the statistics in the background and actually writing the story of what happened and why this was important, et cetera, is fundamental. And the statistics are supportive evidence, but not the core of what we're trying to achieve. It was also the case, I discovered later, that my future two examiners, James Mayall and Ian Clark, were in the room. So I think Jeffrey might have been anticipating the questions that they were going to ask me as part of my viva.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, I remember distinctly sitting in a lecture where two widely read and very well respected historians were debating chaos theory and nonlinearity and what role that would play. And they got a number of questions in the same kind of vein that you mentioned. And their kind of astute response was not to explain the science behind or the mathematics behind nonlinearity, but just to look out at the crowd and say, what are you afraid of?
Uh-huh.
And I think that's actually kind of a valuable question to ask people who are unfamiliar with quantitative methods. And it is often challenging to teach yourself or to learn those quantitative methods, but to recognize that they are simply a method by which to get at what happened rather than something to fear. I have to say, what made me afraid of your book is the volume of work you did. Is looking at these newspapers. I'm glad it was you and not me. So how did you choose what sources to look at, what newspapers to look at, newspapers rather than TV? How did you make those kind of choices? And how did you actually sit down and do this analysis?
Right. Yeah, I mean, I guess in the first newspapers versus TV. I mean, it's a good question. You know, in the 1990s, I think it was Boutros Ghali who said that CNN is now the 16th member of the Security Council. And there was a feeling that, you know, graphic images that shocked the conscience of mankind were going to have a very tangible effect on people's decision making. And so Senator Dianne Feinstein was famously quoted as referring to an image from Srebrenica of a young woman hanging from a tree, and that changed fundamentally her view on what policy should be pursued. Now, certainly TV has an incredibly important influence, but there are a couple of points that are worth noting. One is that in the UK, in particular, past studies by people like Nick Gowing, who himself is a television presenter, re-emphasize the fact or reconfirm the fact that in fact it's the quality press that appears to be an editorial opinion in particular that appears to be most important in influencing British policymakers. Added to that is the fact that, of course, there are, you know, are clipping services, so that you know, even when I worked in politics, every morning there was a stack that was a summary of the news that had come through, and it was print. So that tended to be reconfirmed in some of the interviews that I undertook. You know, Malcolm Rifkin talked about the fact that what he learned was the same as what the public learned because they were all reading the same newspapers. And Tony Blair also made the point, and I think this is also borne out by previous analyses, that, you know, there is a relationship between the two, that very often, despite the fact that the mediums are different and that you can convey different types of information with a different intensity and depth electronically versus in print, that, you know, often the electronic media took their ideas for stories and analysis from the print media. And of course, I think that there's a reverse influence as well. So all of this to say that there was a substantive argument as to why print media was going to be a better set of data in terms of looking at political effect. There was also a very pragmatic reason, because this research, I think I started, 15, 18 years ago. I can't even remember when, a long time ago, but long before LexisNexis and this, right? And so the data was derived from a CD-ROM at the Cambridge University Library. And when I tried to go and get electronic data on television, on the BBC or ITN, et cetera, there was no guarantee that it was complete. There was a BBC archives at Reading that I visited for a week and came to the conclusion that I couldn't guarantee that even if I retyped all of the data or the material that was there, which was very good, that I couldn't assure that it was complete, that I had everything. And moreover, just the sheer amount of time that it would have taken to transform that data into an electronic format for analysis was ultimately prohibitive. So for reasons of substance and necessity, the print media made a great deal of sense in terms of what to look at. There's also, as you know, a tradition in Britain of war reporting, and that being a place where British journalists had a tremendous influence in the past. So for historical reasons as well, the print media made a great deal of sense. In terms of, you know, selecting methods, I mean, I think we've alluded to it already that, you know, there is a danger that if you simply run regressions, you're going to find answers and correlations which you may be unable to explain unless you're actually talking to people who were involved in decision-making of a crisis or whatever social science phenomenon it happens to be. And so as a hedge or as a counterweight to just a strict statistical analysis, obviously there was a chunk of background reading that I did, but also, you know, these interviews, again, were absolutely central because, you know, you could go, or I did go and took the results with me and said, okay, here is what this looks like in terms of statistical results. How does that fit your recollection of what was happening at the time? Right. And so both in terms of, in some cases, helping steer the line of statistical analysis or in helping in the interpretation of the data, meeting all of these decision makers and journalists from the time was absolutely central to getting a more complete, rounded picture of what we think is going on in this analysis.
When you started, or let me back up. Did historians or social scientists or people writing about media coverage in Rwanda, as you were starting this research, was there kind of a pre-existing consensus on the role of British media and its coverage of Rwanda when you were starting?
So there was, and only recently I think this has changed, but there was very little analysis writ large on the role of the media in British political decision-making. There was, I remember a book, reading a book by, I think it was Martin Shaw, called Global Civil Society and the Media or something along those lines. And so in contrast with the United States, where there was an emerging literature, I think in part driven by you know, what happened in Somalia and the way in which that was interpreted, Stephen Livingstone and others doing quantitative research in that form. In the UK, there was far less to hand. What there was in the case of Rwanda were, I would say, you know, very immediate reflections from many journalists and analysts and others who sought to understand or to explain what it was that had happened. And I mean that not in the sense of what happened on the ground, but the ways in which the media contributed to, depending if in one view or failed in another, or were responsible, in the phrasing of one article that I read, for the genocide. Now, one can understand where that, I suppose, emotional underlying impulse comes from, because, you know, the tragedy and the horror of Rwanda, you know, people wanted to explain what had gone wrong. But I guess there were two points. One is that ultimately the analyses were not they were based on anecdotal evidence. Let's put it that way. And impressions of people, some of whom had actually been involved, and who in the case of one off-the-record interview, which is not in the book, and felt a sense of responsibility for not having done as much as they could to draw attention to the crisis. This is something that I deal with in the book and try and counter, because I don't think that that's necessarily true. More recently, in the last number of years, there have been new analyses that have done. Hazel Cameron has written a book. There's another book called The Ignorant Bystander, all of which are sort of contributing to, you know, a better understanding of what happened. And in some cases, the analysis that I've undertaken supports some of the conclusions, and in some cases, it goes very much in a different direction, or at least provides additional layers of understanding, I hope, beyond some of the things that have been written before.
So you look really closely at the more or less the calendar year of 1994. So let's start by saying, just asking, what did British, ordinary British citizens know about what was going on in Rwanda in that first month or two or three of 1994?
Yeah, it's a good question, and it's hard to answer that in the sense that, you know, I have a sense of what the newspapers were writing about, but I'm not sure that it was entering the conscience or consciousness of British citizens. Certainly not in the same way as Bosnia Herzegovina was because of the British commitment there. So I think, you know, both in terms of the level of coverage and in terms of understanding. In that sort of pre-genocide phase in advance of 6 April, I think it's fair to say that the understanding would have been relatively limited. And, you know, Britain has, of course, historic links to Uganda, a neighboring country, but no historic links to Rwanda per se. There was no British diplomatic representation or no embassy in Rwanda. It was covered, if I remember correctly, out of Uganda. And so the sources or the amounts of input that could be provided both to the public and also, for that matter, to within the precincts of officialdom were more limited than they would have been for other countries in which there was a core interest or a historical link. I think one of the things that's interesting is that, you know, in the very limited amount of coverage that takes place in phase one, this is in the pre-genocide phase up to 6 April, there were a number of stories that actually made it very clear that there was a risk of violence, not just in Rwanda, but in Burundi because of the link between those two countries. And so you would have had to look awfully hard for it, but there were a couple of stories and a couple of indications of the problems that were emerging with the broad-based transitional government and also the resurgence of a degree of political violence that could have been understood as early warning, a partial early warning of what was to come.
And you mentioned phase one. And so what you do in the book is to divide the crisis into four phases. So maybe could you just kind of quickly go over what those phases were? And I know this is asking an enormous amount of you in a short period of time, but maybe summarize the way in which media responded in each of these four phases.
Sure, no, happily. I mean, so the purpose of dividing the crisis into four phases, one way to do it is to say, okay, based on the data, we're going to divide, you know, these phases up. The other way to do it is to say, okay, based on major events that were taking place, we're going to separate out analytic time periods and then compare them to one another. Phase one is the period in advance of the genocide. Phase two is the period at the peak of the genocide. Phase three is where the refugee crisis, where there is continued violence in parts of Rwanda, but the refugee crisis begins in earnest. And phase four is the post-crisis phase in which there is a diminishing level of attention. And I think, you know, without going into the depths of the statistics around it, one finds that there are some interesting things that emerge as a result of these four phases. So in the first phase of media crisis, there has traditionally, or one of the criticisms has been, that coverage misrepresented the nature of what was going on. It failed to identify the underlying causes and organization of the violence. And it was slow to declare what was happening as a genocide. Now, those statements are true of some parts of the coverage of the crisis. And in the book, of course, I separate out what I describe as center-right newspapers and center-left newspapers. But when you look at the quality of the coverage and the accuracy of the coverage, there's no monopoly on quality on the center-left or the center-right. So, you know, the Times had Catherine Bond writing, who very quickly was writing about governmental involvement and government force involvement, not just in dealing with Unimir and the very sad death of a series of peacekeepers, but also in the organization at the checkpoints, et cetera, et cetera. Lindsay Hilsum was doing the same. Mark Hubend also. And Mark Doyle, who was with the BBC, he made the point in a chapter that he wrote for a book that, you know, at the start, you know, it did look chaotic. But if that's the case, that understanding of chaos quickly transformed into something quite different on the part of most of the journalists that were on the ground, or many of the journalists that were on the ground. And they were accurately reflecting certainly the scale of the violence, the brutality of the violence at these variety of checkpoints that had been assembled by the Interahamwe. And in some cases, not all, they were accurately reflecting on the underlying political drive that appeared to be part of this. So right away one sees, you know, that, you know, in looking at phase two, the well-meaning criticism that the media failed actually is not entirely accurate. And so then if you look at in comparison with that high quality coverage, again, accurately reflecting events on the ground and also doing a pretty reasonable job of reflecting on the politics and the Security Council, et cetera, there is a gap between that and the quality or the level of engagement of the opinion and editorial pages. And that's extremely interesting because, as I mentioned before, you know, we traditionally think that the editorial pages have, and particular columnists have, a tremendous influence on decision-making. But when you look at the editorials, you know, the high caliber coverage on the ground was not always reflected in the analysis and the editorial opinions that were being expressed. There were one or two exceptions very early on. The Guardian, I think in the first week, published an editorial saying that a serious reinforcement of Unimir was now required. But then that level of focus diminished very quickly. And this was interesting because General Dallaire, Major General Dallaire, who I interviewed for the book, made exactly that point, you know, that he had deliberately set up a pooled system of reporters so that the resources that he had, and he indicates that this was quite intentional, that he was trying to use the media to influence decision makers, was able to get them out to the stories, hence the accurate reporting, but that he did not engage at the editorial level in the newsrooms of influential newspapers, et cetera. And I think he cites that in the interview, and I cite him in the book as saying that was potentially a failure, not just of coverage, but also of his engagement. So this is a long answer. There's lots more to say about phase two of the crisis in terms of what concepts and words were most prevalent. But a second dimension when one compares phase two and phase three, so again, the peak of the crisis and the refugee phase, is that when you compare the amount of coverage total per week, look at what in statistics is called the difference of means test to see if there's a statistical difference between the level of coverage in those two phases, there is no difference. Yes, it is slightly higher in phase three, but that difference is not statistically significant. Now, what does that tell us? It in a sense, runs counter to another very traditional explanation, which is that once the refugee crisis started, that the refugee crisis was massively overcovered compared to the crisis during the peak of the genocide, during that second phase. You know, we're able to see that actually there was not as much of a difference. Yes, it's true that in the first 2 weeks of what I describe as phase three, there was a surge in reporting, but that the overall difference between the two phases is explained by differences not in reporting on the ground or political reporting, but by changes in analysis, letters to the editor, etc. So this gives rise to the possibility of what I talk about as a multiplier effect, which admittedly taking place in phase three, so beyond the point where it could have influenced decision-making in that critical second phase during the genocide, but where one sees the dynamic of how coverage can evolve and snowball. Again, I call it a multiplier effect, but effectively it's a snowballing of coverage where different types of story, when written, produce another type of story. So a report from on the ground produces a statement in Parliament, which is reported upon. That report then leads to a letter to the editor or a piece of analysis trying to explain what's happening. And gradually, each one feeds off the other so that once there's analytic interest in a story, then there's a greater incentive to report from the field and also a greater incentive for politicians to maybe say something about what's happening. So again, the four-phase division, and I'm not covering all of the kind of findings, but broadly speaking, it allows for that type of comparison and in a sense, the a statistical testing of some of the received wisdom. And as I've just pointed out, there are two good examples of received wisdom which are not borne out by this analysis.
Oh, that's fascinating. That's a wonderful summary. If I could, so I know that at least among my journalist friends, they will talk about the difference between text and images. Is there a way for you to capture that? And to what degree are there, I mean, is photojournalism an important part of the coverage that reporters are doing? And how would you measure the impact of pictures as opposed to words?
Yeah, it's a good question, and I don't have a very good answer. I mean, I have tendencies towards Luddism, and I'm fairly hopeless, right, when it came to using textual analysis programs. So the prospect of trying to categorize images was beyond my mental capacity at the time. And so it's a good question, and I don't really have a very good answer. I mean, what I've seen in looking at some images, or even when a friend of mine and I would be looking at an article, and that article would be accompanied by an image, that the images could lend themselves to different interpretations as well.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that room for interpretation is reduced in the text that follows, right? Mm-hmm. And so in a sense, the image can, I think, draw people into an interest or horror or some emotional connection to what's going on. Certainly, I mean, we saw that in images in Sudan and elsewhere that were just absolutely brutal. But it's the narrative that comes with it that ultimately is going to give context to that image, and also that narrative, which is going to, if we believe, Nick Gowing, which I do, and others, is going to give meaning to politicians that are thinking not just about being outraged, which they are obviously, but about what is it that we can actually do about this in practical terms. So I think, from that point of view, this was one of the reasons why, both because of my ineptitude and also because of the value of the language and the role that played in decision making, I ended up focusing much more on the textual side. I don't know. I mean, I'd be interested in hearing what your journalist friends say about that, how they see that link.
Yeah, that would be a really interesting discussion. I think there is a belief that images are often more influential than words. But I've never seen, and I'm not a media studies person, so there may be studies on this I'm not aware of. But I've never seen any real careful attempt to analyze how that works and to what degree that's true. And if people who, I don't know if people who are mesmerized by an image go on to read the story or simply look at the image and move on. I mean, I guess it's another book topic for you in all your free time.
yeah, that's right. You know, there's an
interesting...
Go ahead.
Yeah, go. No, go ahead.
So I think that, what you were just saying reminded me. I remember getting onto, God, I can't even remember where it was now, but getting onto a helicopter somewhere. And we had a journalist from a very prominent Western newspaper. And, it was a big emergency and there was a fairly substantial humanitarian and security and crisis and a military conflict that was causing these things. And as we got onto this helicopter to go to this particular area, the journalist was lamenting the fact that they didn't have a photographer. And the point that they were making is that their chances of getting a prominent place in their newspaper were greater if the photographer was actually able to take photographs rather than if that person was just writing a story. Now, to my recollection, and it wasn't my decision to take, but I think we ultimately found, you know, a bag of something for the photographer to sit on. And the poor guy sat there and felt, I'm sure, nauseous the whole way or bounced around. But the anecdote, I suppose, is to the point about the impact that that the images have in getting the written word in a prominent position in a newspaper, you know, page one above the fold kind of thing.
Yeah. And of course now, not really relevant to your book, but with the new internet culture of newspapers and friends of mine who work in news tell me that the way newspapers are framed and edited has changed completely, that at least the newspapers they worked at, the first thing they worry about is the way it will look online, and then the last thing they worry about is how it will actually look in print.
Right.
And images have again become even more important. So there's lots more to say about the media coverage, but I'm keeping an eye on the time. You also look at the parliamentary debate, and you try and see if there's some kind of feedback loop or some kind of way in which the media coverage influences the debate. So maybe we can start that by just very briefly outlining what we now know about the policy of the British government toward events in Rwanda and the factors that shaped that policy.
Sure. I mean, it's an interesting case because there was a very clear, well-established, I think, position in parts of the British government that was articulated in Parliament at the start of the crisis. And I go through this a little bit in the book, but there was, an understandable skepticism about what people were framing as the New World Order. There was that great line that is attributed to Prime Minister Thatcher, where when someone said to her, Francis Fukuyama is talking about the end of history, she said, "The end of history, the beginning of nonsense." and so in that hopeful moment where people were proclaiming a new world order where the weak would be protected from the strong, et cetera, there was a skepticism that would be borne out in the reality of what would unfold. And I think many of those that made that argument would likely feel vindicated by how things have since unfolded. There was a second element, which was, and I think that this was a common thread in some of the interviews that I had with British decision makers, that that there was a limited capacity to actually intervene, that the limits of Britain's military capacity were not infinite, and that there was an understanding based on what was argued to be Britain's experience in Northern Ireland that this was not also a commitment of months, that it was potentially a commitment of quite a number of years, et cetera, et cetera. So that was, I think, a second component about capacity and the nature of what was required. And then I think a third one, and it's interesting because I think this has been borne out by some of the interviews that, again, I've done, especially with Sir Malcolm Rifkind, is that there was not a complete understanding of the dynamics of such crises and the ways in which intervention could be undertaken. Sir Malcolm, in the interview, which is quoted in the conclusion of the book, essentially makes that point that, he feels differently now, as many others do, about the probability of success. And so if Rwanda was unfolding over a number of months and there was the prospect of doing something, I'm paraphrasing him now, but his answer is yes. Prime Minister Blair said the same thing in the interview that I conducted with him. And of course, in the case of Sierra Leone, his government did act. It acted in other cases as well, as we all know. with results that were varied, but nevertheless, that this interventionist impulse did sort of turn around. So, I think those were four factors. And again, I mean, you know, to their credit, they were articulated very clearly at the outset of the crisis, with you know Lord Hurd in the Commons saying that we shouldn't pretend that we can do everything, and we don't have the ability to act as a policeman or judge or universal soldier. And that fact doesn't mean that we can't do anything. Bosnia-Herzegovina is in Europe, and that is something that we're already committed to, et cetera. So all of this to say that one can litigate the merits of the arguments that were made, but there was no policy ambiguity within the British government. I think that's probably the best way to put it. I think the other dimension is that, you know, there was an internal political question. So again, Sir Malcolm Rifkin, when interviewed for the book, and of course he was defense secretary and a very successful and well-regarded defense minister among other roles that he played. You know, in the interview for the book, he made the point that even in the case of Bosnia-Herzegovina, it was becoming jolly difficult to keep the entire cabinet on board with a military commitment from Britain there, and that there were other very senior ministers who felt that a commitment in Bosnia was arguably a mistake. So his point, of course, is because we were discussing Rwanda, is that if it was difficult to convince cabinet to commit in a military manner, British cabinet, to Bosnia-Herzegovina, it was going to be even more difficult politically to convince them to commit to Rwanda. And of course, you know, he didn't make this argument, but one wonders if one had come with another request for action in Rwanda, would that have undermined the argument on Bosnia-Herzegovina? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, I suppose the question that one asks as a result is, well, you know, it need not have been Britain on its own. Was there the possibility of a coalition? Was there the possibility of a diplomatic engagement through the Security Council? And of course, the Security Council had many debates, both open and closed, and some of the records of those debates have since become public. but were there other things short of a British-led intervention that could have been done? And I think arguably the answer that they've come to themselves is yes. So I think that's an interesting point of departure. The one other thing that I'll say on this just very briefly, because I think it's important, is that there has been, or even at the time of the crisis, there was one columnist who, I think reflecting on the decisions that Great Britain was making, said that that the intelligentsia, I think he used the phrase English intelligentsia, I'm sure he meant British, was such that there was an undeclared racism, and that you know, that the people of Rwanda, and here again I'm paraphrasing, were seen as savages who were irrational, and this was ungovernable and uninfluencible, and therefore no action should be taken. I mean, my experience in both the discussions with these people who I think this columnist would have charged with that is that's not the case. Now, setting absence of racism as a benchmark is probably not particularly helpful, but certainly there was, and I think it's again reflected in the interviews, a recognition that a mistake was made, and that finding a way in which to deal with future similar situations, as the British government did in the post-crisis phase, where they came up with a number of ideas, Lord Hurd in the General Assembly, at the UN General Assembly and a number of others, on how to forestall such crises in future, positions that were entirely consistent with their view that Britain could not play the role of world policeman. So, you know, there was an argument about the norms that would govern that Prime Minister Blair took up, and actually which Lloyd Axworthy, again, who I worked for in my first job after grad school, took up as part of the International Commission on Intervention and State Sovereignty, but also from, you know, Lord Hurd, ideas about how the OAU could play a more prominent preventive and peacekeeping role in crises that emerge. So again, it's a case where you know, one can argue the merits and demerits of each of those ideas, and I think that they're sort of rarely is one a unanimous success. They're all a mixed bag. But the point was that you know, they were not simply uninterested. They were actually were interested in trying to make a difference. It's just that during the peak of the crisis, that did not happen.
So most of that discussion quite reasonably focused on cabinet level discussions. How extensive was discussion in Parliament itself?
That's right. I mean, the first observation that's worth making is that the total number of interventions in Parliament, in both the Commons and the Lords, was 184. And that's, you know, roughly two-thirds in the House of Commons and one-third in the House of Lords. And that's about 10% of the total number of news stories that were written about the crisis. So the first observation is that there is a very big difference, a massive number of order of magnitude of the level of individual attention that Rwanda had in Parliament from the amount of newspaper coverage that it received. Now, that's not a fair metric because obviously parliamentary debate is a very different thing than writing a news story. But I would say that overall, with the exception of a number of very committed and very strong and I think we could also say principled individuals like particularly Tony Worthington and a number of others, there was not a broad-based level of interest in the crisis. And, you know, there are a variety of reasons for that. I think, you know, Prime Minister Blair in the interview with him, you know, indicated that the Labour Party was focused on succession. I mean, and that there were a number of elements that were attracting attention elsewhere, which meant that Rwanda perhaps didn't receive the consideration that it deserved. When I interviewed Tony Worthington for the book, he became a cabinet minister. I think maybe he was working on Northern Ireland. You know, he made the point that that the intervention that he took, which was one of the longer ones, took place in the context of an adjournment debate. And the phrase that he used was, that, you know, an intervention at the end of the day while a million people have died, it's sick. And so that was, I thought, telling and also very interesting. But I would also say that for the most part, you know, there was never a moment in Parliament where someone said, you know, here is what we should be doing. There was never a moment in the media, except with the exception maybe of the op-ed that I referred to earlier, where an op-ed or an analysis came out and said, look, here are the four things that Britain can do right now or that the UN can do right now to forestall, slow, prevent, whatever it might be, this crisis from continuing. And so oddly, I would say that both the media and in Parliament, there was a consensus that this was desperate and outrageous, but little indication of what ought to be done in order to remedy the situation. And I think interesting that probably has changed since that time. If we look at the vote that was undertaken by Prime Minister Cameron's government on airstrikes in Syria, that was 4 years ago, 3 years ago, I don't remember when. That evidenced a level of parliamentary engagement. It was a very different issue, of course, than what we saw in the case of Rwanda. So again, I mean, I think it was interesting that there was not a groundswell of support. Some of the bigger players who were very involved in Bosnia-Herzegovina, Patty Ashdown, Robin Cook, were not showing a great deal of interest in talking a lot about Rwanda.
So in the way you phrased that, and I don't remember the exact words you used, but you essentially presented parliamentary and media opinions and discussions as proceeding in parallel. To what extent do they, or at least maybe adopting similar positions without necessarily having a feedback, does the media coverage actually influence these debates, or can we know that?
Yeah. So I think the answer is yes. And so one of the things that I spend time on, because ultimately it was the real purpose or the test that I wanted to try, was looking at, okay, what are the relations between you know, we have 156 media concepts that we've looked at, and we've, you know, tried to work out how they might influence things. We've pared that down to 15. Now, of those 15, when we use multivariate statistics, and I'll try and keep this relatively simple, but when we use multivariate statistics, what do we find out about what types of concepts, when used in the media, appear to correlate with the amount of parliamentary debate? And there, the findings are actually kind of interesting, and are also, you know, intuitively sensible. So, for example, over the course of the entire year, human rights has the greatest influence over the amount of parliamentary debate. Huh. And for those that are so inclined, there the R squared value is at 0.286. So that's a measure of the level of explanation that's being achieved between those two variables. In phase two, you have a similar level of explanation, but for one variable, and that's military intervention. So the more that the media is talking about military intervention, the more Parliament is talking about the crisis in Rwanda. And that also is sensible, because if you are, as a matter of conviction, do not want to intervene in the crisis and have reasons that you feel explain why that is, when a newspaper says we should intervene, you may feel a sense of obligation to refute that argument, or you may feel a desire to support that argument, but that's a concept that really matters. And then in phase four, and I'll come to the kind of broad conclusion in a minute, disease and refugees becomes really important. And there we have a very high level of explanation, the R squared of 0.407, but with what's described as a negative beta coefficient. So it's a negative relationship between the two variables. So the more that the media is talking about disease and refugees, the less Parliament is debating Rwanda as a whole. And so there's the suggestion, and I think that, you know, this would require more analysis and disentangling, but what it seems to suggest is statistical evidence, or statistical proof is too strong, but some evidence of what we've traditionally talked about as compassion fatigue, right? That when a crisis receives a lot of attention, gradually people dial out. And so here by phase four, you know, other things are being discussed, and disease and refugees, which is extremely important in phase three, becomes less important. And then two final observations, and then kind of the punchline of all of this statistical stuff. When one looks finally at lagging media coverage with parliamentary debates, so when I compare, for example, day one coverage or week one coverage in the media with week three in parliamentary debate, you come up with a surprisingly strong model, which explains 64%, 65% of the variability in parliamentary debate. And those concepts are human rights, regional impact, and other crises. So here, again, you know, we're seeing, broadly speaking, conclusion one is that concepts actually matter, and they mattered far more than the raw amount of coverage. So the content of coverage is extremely important, or a better predictor, or a better achieves better correlations with parliamentary debate than the absolute amount of parliament of media coverage. Sorry. So that's one big conclusion. Now, the other way to look at it, and you may remember that you know, Noam Chomsky and Edward Herman did a lot of work on manufacturing consent, and there was a lot of work done by Daniel Holland on this as well, in the Uncensored War about Vietnam, if I remember correctly. And, you know, the other possibility, the other argument is that, you know, politicians are seeking to use the media. And, you know, we know that to be the case, just even based on an interview again with Prime Minister Blair, where he said exactly that for this book. So the question then is, okay, is Parliament in any way affecting the amount, parliamentary debate affecting the amount of media coverage? Now, the answer to that is that in terms of concepts, not really. And broadly, in terms of the amount of parliamentary debate, not really either, with one exception, which is that the amount of parliamentary debate affects the amount of media debate or media coverage 1 week afterwards. So all of this to say that we have what I talk about as a dual movement of sorts, where we have the media, their conceptual content affecting the amount of debate in particular phases, in particular ways. We have a lag where 2 weeks afterwards, it appears that certain concepts are giving us a really good explanation of the amount of parliamentary debate, but we also have the amount of parliamentary debate feeding into the amount of media coverage. And I suppose in a sense, this is probably a good thing in the sense that if we believe that one of the cornerstones of a functioning democracy is a watchdog or a third estate or whatever that is engaged with the political process and in turn is influenced by the political process, this seems to suggest that that process is going on in one way or another in this, again, small microcosm of a debate about Rwanda.
So there's a lot. So first of all, I will say that John is far better at statistics than I am, especially while I'm still a cup or coffee too down this morning. But the analysis in the book is remarkably thorough. And I would encourage you, if you're interested in this, to go to buy the book or get the book and look at his work, because he's done an amazing amount of very careful, thorough analysis and statistical work. And it deserves to be carefully considered. We've taken a lot of your time, John. So to just quickly conclude the kind of discussion of the book, is there a broad, and I know this is not fair, but I guess I kind of am in charge, so I'll ask anyway. Is there just a lesson or two that you could abstract out of this book that looks at a particular crisis at a particular point in time for journalists or policymakers or citizens, I suppose, about the relationship between media and policy decisions and how they get made at moments of crisis?
So it's a good question, and in a sense, some of it is, I don't want to say idle speculation, but close to idle speculation on my part, which is not analyzed statistically, and so for which I don't have some, piece of evidence that is undeniable and confirms what I'm about to say. I guess there are a couple of things. So one is that, if you look at the types of concepts that appear to influence the amount of parliamentary debate, and you understand that that varies depending where we are in a crisis. If you are an NGO or a government or a political actor of one form or another, you can gather ideas about the things that you want to be reported in the media that are likely to have an effect on parliamentary debate. Now, there's a big, loop that takes place between the reference and parliamentary debate, but nevertheless, you can start to get an idea or glean clues as to the kind of discussion that's going to gather attention for a particular crisis. And again, it's borne out, what I was just describing about human rights, military intervention, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that's one important point. The second is that, there is a distinction in the nature of coverage between these different types of story, and that we can have highly successful or very successful or good quality reporting on a crisis and the political response to it, but that is not going to necessarily produce the editorials that we think are going to actually ultimately influence political decision making. And so if, again, you're looking at the channels of influence, good reporting is a prerequisite. It gives you ideas about the types of story and nature of words that need to be used. But that discussion in the editorial rooms, as General Dallaire pointed out for this book, is absolutely central. So I think that those are two broad conclusions that one can make based on the analysis. The other one is, and this is where I enter into the realm of partially informed speculation, is that, in the heat or in the midst of a large-scale crisis, it's very difficult to run against the grain of established orthodoxy and established wisdom in whatever issue it might be. I think that this probably applies to domestic issues on the economy or in Canada, Aboriginal rights or whatever it might be, First Nations, et cetera. And I think certainly it was the case in Rwanda that, there was an understanding of where we were in the cycles of changes in global politics. Again, I refer back to Margaret Thatcher's comment on the beginning of nonsense. But also that there was not a clear understanding of how one could deal with such crises most effectively and what place the use of force had and what the realities were on the ground. And so in a sense, you know, policy change in the aftermath of a crisis appears to be easier to achieve. Now, I make the point in the book that, you know, that means that 1 million people in Rwanda, 800,000, however you want to calculate it, were in a crucible that changed the practice of the international system for how long we have yet to see. But that's of little comfort to the family of those 800,000 people. But, you know, it's the political science point or the, you know, a political decision-making point versus wanting to do something to alleviate a crisis at the time that it's taking place. So I think those are maybe three sort of broad observations. Yeah.
No, that's fascinating. You've given me a lot to chew on.
Okay.
So that's great. I always end with the same question. Although I have to preface it a little bit different, because usually I preface this question with what should I read this weekend? And in the U.S. anyway, it's coming close to the end of the spring semester, and I'd be lying to everyone if I said I was going to read anything other than exams and student papers. But in a week or two, all things come to an end, and I'll have a weekend in theory where I have time to read and reflect. Is there something you read or maybe watched or heard while you were doing this research that either changed your way of thinking or touched you on an emotional level? What should the listeners and I read?
Oof, gosh. I mean, part of the challenge is that it took me so long to complete this book that I read an awful lot of things in the intervening period. So, I mean, I remember, and I think mainly, you know, Percy Jackson to my son and the Chronicles of Narnia to my daughter, so I can recommend both of those. And they're both cheaper to purchase than this book and also may keep the reader more awake. I mean, I found, so as I was trying to write this up, I mentioned my father before and my mother, and of course they both had a huge impact in terms of my personal life, which goes without saying, but also academically. And my father is a historical geographer, and he wrote a book called Land Power and Economics on the Frontier of Upper Canada, which won this thing called the Meridian Award, which is kind of the outstanding nerd's scholarly work in geography, right? Kind of the best book or scholarly contribution. And he won it in 2001. And I remember both, of course, reading it before it was published, but then coming back to it afterwards for the following reason. I said, you know, at the outset that, you know, quantitative analysis can sometimes just be overwhelming. And one really has to ask why one is applying multivariate statistics or whatever it might be. And then in turn, to make sure that when you write it up, that it's written with the substance of the content in mind and not with the statistics up front. And so I actually turned back to my father's book, Land Power and Economics, and more recently, The Ordinary People of Essex, just as a way of looking at, and hopefully he won't listen, so he won't realize that I'm paying him a compliment. But just as a way of trying to see, okay, because my dad's work is similar. I mean, he's a historian in one sense, but he was at the start of the quantitative revolution in the social sciences. And so he's much more of a number cruncher and far more clever about these things than I am. And so I turned to his work just to see how it was that he'd written some of his conclusions up. And that was also interesting because, you know, at the end of some of these things, having done some of these interviews, you know, you have an insight into, and as I said, I mean, I have the additional advantage of the people that I interview being alive, whereas my father works in the mid-1800s and so in Upper Canada, and so they tend to not be around quite as much. But, you know, you have this insight into how people thought about things, and in a way, writing that up in a manner that is true to the analysis, but also is, I don't want to say kind or charitable, but which is faithful to the actual person. You know, it's very easy when you meet people who were in decision-making roles to, you know, be dismissive or very critical of the decisions that they took, and perhaps not to listen as carefully as to why they took a particular decision. And even if one agrees, to understand that there were reasons and explanations, even if one disagrees with them. And I think that that ability to have dialogue with those with whom you disagree is probably more important now than ever before. Yeah. Not just academically, but I think politically in many G8 countries, you know, finding a way to talk to the person and the necessity of talking to the person that you disagree most with is now more important than ever before. So there you go. That's my thought on what to read. My dad's book, The Chronicles of Narnia and Percy Jackson, not necessarily in that order.
Well, it's a great point, and I try and help my students understand that in a world in which the culture is not necessarily encouraging them to be that open and aware. So I appreciate your making it, and I appreciate the time that you've taken. It's been a wonderful conversation. The book is excellent, and I hope that people will go out and look it up and read it. But thank you so much for your time.
Kelly, thank you very much, and thank you for hosting this series. I think it's really great that you do this, both for the authors and also to, you know, generously expose the work of others and allow them to gain a broader audience for work that often remains hidden, you know, in the bowels of libraries. So thank you very much for having me on.
Thank you, and I hope we'll have a chance to have you on again. But until then, have a great rest of your year. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Kelly. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to an interview with John Nathaniel Clark about his new book, British Media and the Rwandan Genocide. If you enjoyed this interview, you can listen to previous podcasts through iTunes or Stitcher or other podcast providers, or from the webpage for New Books and Genocide Studies, part of the New Books Network of podcasts. I hope you'll join me next time when I talk with Adam Smith and John Cox about the way they went about writing textbooks about genocide. Until then, thanks for the download and have a great month.